Morning. Morning. And good morning. So this morning I'm going to talk about Zen and sexuality. And I'd specifically like to thank a woman I've never met named Reverend Vajra Karuna at the International Buddhist Meditation Center in Los Angeles for her work in this area, for her research in this area. A lot of other people I can thank too, but thanking her right now. Okay, so starting off with basic Zen again, for those of you who are here with me all the time, for those of you who are not here all the time, maybe for the first time, all life is interconnected. We're connected to everything. Everything and everyone. Every being and every piece of dust within the earth and around it, within the entire universe. And we're connected right here at this moment. So consequently, there's unconditional worth in this. In this. In this very little tiny piece of dust that's floating in my water. I don't know who did that. I'm supposed to only drink purified water, but there it is. There it is. Unconditionally worthy, because it is. Because it is. Basic fundamental truth of Zen. Because things are, they are fundamentally worthy. Because within one thing is everything. Everything is manifested by one thing. So there's with no ifs, ands, or buts, right? Not if I do better at my Zazen practice, if I finally clean up my mind, if I finally figure out what right sexuality is. Right now. No ifs, ands, or buts. This is our central teaching, our central practice to manifest that. But it's the teaching. First, you have to believe it as a teaching. Even if you just believe it in your head, that believing it more and more in your head, and you see it. You see it. No ifs, ands, or buts. So our practice is to awaken to this present wholeness, to this present completeness in its very imperfection, in its very flawedness. And this means some freedom from our alienation, from each other, from ourselves, from whomever, whatever. If I'm alienated from something, from someone, I feel negative. If I'm alienated from my sexuality, I feel negative about my sexuality and then about everything. So in Zen, as those of you guys know who've been around here for a while, we give our whole selves to our practice in this moment, which means that we're accepting our unconditional Buddha worth. Or you could say no Buddha worth if you prefer. Some of you prefer that. That's fine. Our unconditional no Buddha worth. And of course, we also have in Buddhism the middle way, right? The middle way in regard to everything. We overeat to dull our pain. We overeat to deal with our stress. We deafen ourselves to noise, to I don't know why. Because we feel insecure. We want continual noise, continual radio, continual TV, continual stimulation, because we have not settled in to this worth that's here. It's worth that's always here. And some of our entertainment is pretty moronic, pretty stupido, and not in the Zen sense, right? Pretty stupid. Pretty stupid when I see my myself flipping channels at night. They say it's only a male thing, you know. I don't, maybe some of you women do it too. Something about hunting and gathering. I read some study. I don't know. So we do that. We do that. And that's when we do that, then we bring ourselves back to the middle. We exhaust ourselves at work, at jobs, to get stuff for ourselves, to get a better position or a better house or a better this or a better that. And we spend our whole lives doing that, and then we're old and we think, oh, what happened? Shit, what happened? We do that, especially in this country. On the other hand, we then, when we had enough of that, we deprive ourselves, right? We deprive ourselves. I'm not going to ever eat chocolate again. Never. Look what it did to me. I'm not ever going to do this again. Look what it did to me. And then we get our own little solidity around being self-denying. Oh, now maybe I can really practice. But it's the same. It's a reflection of the other, isn't it? Not bad. It's just what we do. It's just what we do. But in Zen, we teach that our most essential need, our most essential want, is to realize that it's all already here. Just as it is, right in the middle of my craving for more chocolate. It's right here. Right here. And one of the problems with sex is, in particular, that sex is so, so wowy. Sex is so wowy that we forget that all the other bodily functions are just as wowy. Because they are. Because they are. We only think this one, this chocolate or this sex, that's it. That's orgasmic, right? But from the Zen point of view, it's wowy just to be sitting down here, just to put my butt on this pillow, just to stand up and say hello, just to go to the bathroom. It's wowy, because it's what is. And the more we see that what is wowy, the less sex and chocolate become this thing, right? It's true. Try it. Try it. So instead of worshiping chocolate or sex, if we worship anything, we worship this. This life. This life. But not that life, this life. Not that life after I get to be a really good teacher. This life. And in regard to sex, what's happened in our culture has been very interesting for those people who are old like me. Because we went through the repressed 40s and 50s. Totally shut down, repressed. Never see a female breast. You couldn't nurse back then. Nobody nursed, really. That's why it was because of the sexualization of the breast, partly, that they cut out nursing. There were other reasons. It was science, I guess, but it was male-dominated science. It was not good science, right? So we have that really a really repressive time, which comes from our Puritan heritage, right? Very repressed. And what's the deal now, you guys? What's the deal now? Turn on your computer. Put PORN in your computer. Just try it. See how many hits you get. And then go look at one of those hits. See what it's like. Have any of you done that? Have any of you not done that? If you've not done that, you should do it because you're in this culture, aren't you? It's not going to hurt you. Do it. And see how we've become so sexualized. We've gone from one extreme. We've reacted as the way human beings do. They bounce between austerity and indulgence because they feel insecure. They want something. We want some security. We want something we can count on. In Zen, we believe that the realization of this unconditional worth is so deep and so profound that sex and chocolate as orgasmic experiences pale in comparison with it. They pale in comparison with it. They're fine. But as hedonistic pursuits, we're missing out. So in traditional Buddhism, there are rules of behavior for lay people and for priests. Lay people, it's fairly loose. You can't have, you're not supposed to have sexual intercourse with minors. That's cool. I mean, that's good. That's appropriate, right? Or with people who are married, except your own spouse. And with those in prisons or in mental institutions. Other than that, providing you're paying attention to suffering and impermanence, there are no rules. If you're increasing your suffering or someone's suffering, then that's not good. That covers over your unconditional worth. Conceals it, and it hurts you and others. And often we're doing it to conceal impermanence over and over again. And that's not good practice either. That's not practice that's whole. And if we're using sex to, if we desire, and we're not getting what we want, and we keep using sex to try to get what we want, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. We just, more and more, we're upset. More and more, we're craving. And then if we use sex and we get what we want, just very similar to chocolate. For me, to chocolate. See, I know more about chocolate than sex. I know plenty about sex, but I really know about chocolate. I have one chocolate bar. I want another chocolate bar. I have one piece of chocolate. I need the whole bar. I want one bar. I have one bar. I want two, three bars. Well, this addiction to chocolate can very easily carry over into other things. I mean, it's similar. We want some pleasure. We want to feel okay, and we cling to that. So the more we get, the more we want. And then what happens? We got it. I got my little stash of chocolate. I don't. I don't want Linda to know about it, the kids to know about it. I'm holding on to this. This is the way I feel good after you guys are all mean to me. I'm making this up, you guys. I gotta make. Well, I have to have something to talk about, right? But it could happen. It could happen. We hold on to it. So, sexuality is cool. But through our practice, we can learn to gain and lose with equanimity. Sex, chocolate, people we love, our own self-image, we can do it. We have that opportunity in our Zen practice. If Zen's not about that, I don't know what it's about. So promiscuity in Zen, from the Zen point of view, is not too cool, because promiscuity usually doesn't work very well. Why are people promiscuous? Well, one thing, to avoid commitment. to avoid commitment to each other and to the world, because they're scared of being committed. And sometimes also they just are too idealistic about the relationship. Oh, this one, I'll try this one. Oh, that didn't work. I'll try this one. Well, then nothing works. Doesn't matter whether it's sexual or in terms of friends. Jeez. If we waited for the ideal partner or the ideal best friend, we'd just be alone for our whole lives. The important thing is to pay attention to the other person's needs and not just your own. And prostitution is not condemned in Zen. Not condemned. What a person does with his or her body is that person's own affair. But what's to be condemned is harming or exploiting. And if it's possible, I don't know if it is, to have prostitution without harming or exploiting, then that's fine. I don't know if that's possible or not. This is not a realm that I have participated in. It's a question of compassion toward others and not abandoning it for the sake of anything. Chocolate, sex, self-image, prestige, anything, anything. And Zen in America is doing okay about sex, but we've had some mishaps at the teacher level, some major mishaps, starting with San Francisco Zen Center, a major mishap at the leader level, at the supposed Roshi level, a major falling down. Not too long after that, we had a major falling down in New York. A very well thought of and very loved Zen teacher. And then here, with this teacher here, this Japanese teacher here, a major falling down. And then, what was the next one? Clouds and Water Zen Center. So, this is something we really need to be careful about. We have not done a good job at Zen in America with sex. At the teacher level. You guys who are not teachers yet probably don't have to worry about it. But at the teacher level, we have done a very, very bad job. But that's okay. We can come back to this unconditional worth at any moment. And if we experience this, then we can share it with others. But we should be able to learn lessons from the past. Human beings have a hard time learning lessons from the past. Look at the Vietnam War, the Iraq War. Is it going to be the Afghan War, you guys? In another 20 years, is our hero Barack Obama? Right now he's still my hero, but I'm nervous. Another 50, is it going to be Afghan? We're going to be doing it again? We don't learn very well, do we? Because we are afraid. Because we don't experience unconditional worth. We don't manifest it. We're afraid. And out of fear, we cling to something. Whatever it is. Some idea. Some sex way of doing sex. Some eating thing. Some ideology. They're all the same. They're all the same. And our teachers have let us down about sexuality. My teachers have let me down. And I'm not going to let you down about that. I hope I don't let you down about anything. But I will never let you down about that. But I'll let you down about something else. Because I'm frail. I'm human. I make mistakes. I get angry. I get upset. But we're unconditionally worthy, just as we are. Just as we are. Okay? This is not made up. Because we're one interdependent whole. Because you manifest the whole thing just now. You're manifesting it. What more could I want? Just when you raise your eyebrow. You're manifesting it. So what about reproductive versus recreational sex? Oh, big religious deal, right, in the West. In the West. But from the Zen point of view, reproductive, recreational, they both begin with R. Well, what I mean is, it's non-judgmental. If you're not hurting somebody, if you're not increasing the suffering in the world, there's no judgment. There's no moral judgment. It's non-dual. It's not separate. Reproductive, recreational, heterosexual, homosexual. What? Different words. Natural and unnatural? Natural and unnatural. Natural and unnatural. Tell me about this. Educate me about natural and unnatural. From a non-judgmental point of view, from a big awareness point of view, what's natural and what's unnatural? Made up. You made it up. You and your culture made it up. We made it up. Now, harmful, hurting, that's not made up. You experience hurting. We all know about hurting. Harm, pain, putting people down. How's that made up? How's that made up?
Excuse me, I'm sorry to interrupt. I've just been informed that they're towing cars along the parkway.
Oh, my. Well. Oh. You know, we do have parking above our above our driveway back there. Jeez.
I went to the Zen Center and my car got towed. Can you believe it? Ever again.
Unconditional worth. So, there's a recognition in Zen that lay life in general and sexuality in particular can often interfere with our practice. And, of course, lots of things can interfere. But sexuality is such a strong libidinal force that it can especially interfere. And that's why Buddhism for 2,500 years has emphasized a monastic lifestyle. Duh. It's not because there's some idea of sex being sinful in Buddhism. Well, that's why. That's why. Oh. because if you want to make waking up to your unconditional worth a really focused activity, it has to be a focused, not just intermittent, not just sometimes activity. It has to permeate your life. And in a monastic setting, it's easier to do that. Now, not always. Monastic people get in all kinds of trips, too. But it can be easier. And that's also why I'm really emphasizing retreats here. When Karen Suna was a teacher before, we had like maybe, I don't know, just a very few retreat days a year. I'm ramping it up every year. And when I first took people on whom I was going to ordain, I told them they have to do 12 days a year minimum. I think that was way too little. Way too. If they want to manifest, maybe they don't care, but if they want to manifest unconditional regard for all life and feel that, and they have to do it more, because that's because we're the rest of the time we're in the world, stuff is coming up, we're getting bombarded by stuff, we're worrying about stuff, we have stuff to take care of. So that's why I think it's so vitally important. So, whatever sexual relationship we have, if it's mutual loving and supportive, that's cool. That's fine. That's fine. So that should mean that there's no homophobia in Zen and Buddhism, right? Sorry, it's not the case. It should mean that because the Buddha scriptures, are, unlike the Bible, don't make references to, in any direct or indirect ways, to acts that are unnatural and, you know, bad, right? Sexual acts. But Asian families, going back to India, number one, really valued the next generation. Really valued how many kids you'd have. The more, the better. Many would die, but to preserve the generations, and people who were gay didn't reproduce. Number, I think that's one of the main things about the Eastern tradition that has made there be homophobia within it. A second one is that the Eastern traditions have generally put down the feminine, have generally made the feminine lesser or weaker, and there's a stereotype that gay people are more feminine-like. So, my teacher, I've had three teachers. One of them is the person whose Dharma I am, Karen Suna. She's lesbian, and she came out when she was at the Zen Center here. That's when she came out. Part of her coming out, she went to see Katagiri Roshi, and she told him what was going on with her and that she was lesbian, and he said, "No, you're not." And that was the end of the discussion. This is what Karen had told me. That was the end of the discussion. She never brought it up to him again. So that's an example of how Asian culture has carried this homophobia within it, just like we have in Western culture. But don't forget, we have a monastic environment for 2,500 years, not unlike the Catholic Church. be careful about criticizing Catholic Church, you Buddhists. Be careful. Be careful. Most Buddhist monks, most Buddhist priests know as little about counseling, about child care, about sexual issues as Catholic priests. Because for generations, they didn't know anything about it. So they didn't learn anything from their teacher. Their teacher didn't learn anything from their teacher. So if we expect more from them, the Asian priests, than we do from Catholic priests, I don't know where we're expecting them to get it, from the ether or something. I mean, that's wonderful if they're just so profoundly enlightened. I mean, I'd like to be that profoundly enlightened. I haven't met anyone like that yet, though. You know, just pick everything up from the ether. Woo! Woo! Maybe that awaits us. So, I don't think a religious tradition or a religious practice can be generally gay-friendly unless it can accept sex in and of itself, regardless of reproduction. And I don't think spirituality is healthy, which doesn't accept the inherent pleasure of sex. In Christianity, we have the sinful idea, and in Buddhism, we have the ignorant prisoners of lust, greed, anger, and hatred. Right? Oh, not sin for us, just greed, anger, and hatred. Well, okay, all right. Okay. So, and then we have this masculine-feminine deal, right? There tend to be religions that are more masculine, and there tend to be religions that are more feminine. Masculine religions tend to see the world as corrupt and impure, ultimately alien, and the body kind of yucky. Kind of yucky body, right? And the human spirit can soar, but the body is yucky. In the goal in patriarchal religions, in male-dominated religions, is to conquer and change the world or escape from the world. Conquer and change it or escape from it. And since women are the bearers of future generations, since they are the body, they embody the body, they give birth to new bodies, and are the seductresses of men. They are the greatest impediments to our liberation. Isn't that, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Isn't it ridiculous? But this has been going on for, a few thousand years, right? A few thousand years. We're doing pretty well. We've only had Buddhism in this country since, 1960. We're doing pretty well at changing that, but this is a long process. This is a long process. The main characteristics of feminine religion are that the world's not impure. The world's what it is. Doesn't need to be changed because we can take delight in it. We can take delight in every aspect of the world. Just as it is. Just as it is. Impurity is only within our own minds, with our own attitudes. In the male-dominated religions, we want to stand out from nature. We want to transcend nature. Transcend my craving for chocolate and sex. Oh, wouldn't that be nice? Well, in the feminine, more feminine-oriented religions, we embrace it. We embrace it. We identify with it. so that we can find release from our alienation from ourselves, from our others, and from the world. Dogen talks about forgetting the self and being intimate with all life. It's got to include sex and chocolate, doesn't it? He didn't say everything but sex and chocolate. Zen is what it is because of the introduction of a strong feminine element at its birth, and that's Taoism. Zen would not be Zen if it were not for Taoism. Tao, the mother, the mysterious female, that's how the Tao is referred to. We return to the Tao, we return to the mother, we return to the mysterious female who is totally empty and yet embraces us all. Taoism. Taoism. Instead of God the Father, whom we're separate from. And of course, Buddha is a male, definitely. But in Buddhism, Buddha in Mahayana Buddhism, Buddha has a mother who is who? Anybody remember who Buddha's mother is in Mahayana Buddhism? Come on, those of you who've been with me for a while. Who is Buddha's mother?
Prajnaparamita.
Right. Thank you, Marty. Prajnaparamita. Thank you. Thank you. Prajnaparamita. She's Buddha's mom. And we know who, that's another talk. But anyway, what some of you don't know who Prajnaparamita, you don't have to know. She's just the mother of everything, totally empty, and the mother of even Buddha. And but most of the other gods and goddesses, aside from Tara, tend to be men in Buddhism. Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion, is a man. He's a guy. But he transforms himself to woman lots of times, so he's a little bit hermaphroditic. So, okay, that's cool. But he's still first a man. So the male still comes first in contrast to Taoism. And that is so different from the Western religions, from Muslim, from Christianity, and from Judaism, where God is here and man is here. And barely the twain shall meet. Barely, and the God is the Father. God is not a mother. It's not flesh of my flesh. As with a mother. And there's only in Christianity, there's only this one singular event when there was a fusion between the Father and and between form and emptiness. And that was Jesus himself, Christ himself. And of course, a few Christian mystics have closed that gap in Western religion. And some of them got in trouble and some of them didn't, right? For doing that. And in shamanic religion, which many of you know I've been into too, most shamanic religion is very, very feminist. Very earth and mother oriented. Now maybe that there's a male hierarchy. I mean, I used to think those shamanic cultures would be just all groovy, but then I spent some time in them, and I'm not going to talk about that right now. All culture, we're all flawed. We're all flawed. So. This woman, Karuna, whatever her name is, Karuna, I would get her name right again. Vajra Karuna says that Zen Buddhism is a feminized masculine religion, and that certain forms of Tantra are feminized masculine. But that Buddhism is essentially a masculine religion. If it weren't for Taoism, And we, you know, I could spend a lot more talks on this. We could look at the scriptures, but you know, I don't even have much time left here. Buddhism has a very strong, especially in the non-Mahayana. We're going to embrace the unconditioned, and we're going to go beyond this conditioned stuff, and we're going to embrace it. And yeah, we'll come back to the condition, but if they're going to come back to it, why don't priests ever marry? Why did priests never marry until just 150 years ago? Yeah. If we're really embracing it, let's embrace it, okay? Well, it's exactly the same thing, same issue. They shouldn't marry either. They shouldn't be sexual either. They would pollute men if they married, and they would even pollute themselves. So exactly the same. Exactly the same. But it is possible, and we are working in this country on having a Zen that really manifests Mahayana, that really manifests this big unconditional worth feeling, not just the idea, but feeling. And we're doing that through our practice and through our lives. And there is some precedent for this. And the precedent is, and the precedent, I think, has been taken to a little bit to an extreme. Like Tantra Buddhism, probably taken to a little extreme, because we go to extremes often when we're reacting against things. But that's red thread Zen. Some of you know a little bit about red thread Zen, right? Do you guys remember red thread Zen? So red thread Zen, which comes from China, Tang China, and from Japanese Zen, but specifically Rinzai, comes from the term, which is a Chinese custom in which a red thread is tied around a new bride's wrist as a sign of hope for a fruitful and happy marriage, the red thread being a symbol of the umbilical cord. So the Zen tradition that embraced this symbol as a way of acknowledging that sexuality was natural aspect of human life and innately good. And probably the most well-known red thread Zen teacher is who? Anybody know? Japanese Zen teacher, considered kind of outlandish sometimes. You're right. Ikkyu was a Rinzai Zen teacher who lived in the 15th century. He was abbot of Daitokuji Monastery, the most prominent Rinzai monastery, where they supposedly produced the most enlightened people. Koan study, you know, they really go for the enlightenment, right? Maybe a little bit too acquisitively, but we won't get into that. Maybe a little bit in too much of a male way, but we won't get into that, right? That can be another talk, right? So Ikkyu embraced red thread Zen. He was very sexual himself. He was very sexually active. Not during his retreats, not when he was doing hard practice, especially as a young man, but whenever he got away from the monastery, he was very sexual. He embraced it. He wrote a lot of poetry about sexuality, about his sexuality. And I'm going to read a little bit of his poetry. I am going to read a little bit about it, a little bit of it. First poem. Oh, so more about Ikkyu is that he really wrote a lot about the hypocrisy of Zen in Japan in the 15th century. The hypocritical attitude toward women and toward sexuality. How there was a lot of gay sex going on in the monasteries, but nobody would write about it or nobody would talk about it, right? And how some of the abbots, the most prominent abbots, would have concubines that they would keep in little rooms in the very, very back of the monastery, so nobody would know. Yeah, it's true. I don't know how much it happened, but he writes about it. His idea was to expose it all, which is cool, right? But he also, you know, you could say he went overboard. I'm just not sure. He frequented prostitutes a lot. He seemed to hang out with them an awful lot, and not just hang out, say hi, but, you know, really. I don't know. He wrote poetry about it. I don't know. So here's one of his poetry, one of his poems. Stilted cons. So he's putting down the cons, right? And he's in Rinzai. Stilted cons and convoluted answers are all monks have. Pandering endlessly to officials and rich patrons. Good friends of the Dharma, so proud. Let me tell you, a brothel girl in gold brocade is worth more than any of you. Okay, there's one of his poems. His poems are mostly like this. They can be fairly graphic, too. I'm not going to read anything graphic this morning because you guys are, you know, not ready for that. That's later today. If you stick around up in my room. So, in these days, in the 15th century, as throughout the history, monks, up until 150 years ago, monks and priests were not allowed to eat meat or fish. So here's one of his poems, A Meal of Fresh Octopus. Lots of arms. Just like Kenon, the goddess, sacrificed for me, garnished with citron. I revere it so. The taste of the sea, just divine. Sorry, Buddha, this is another precept I just cannot keep. Okay, a couple more poems by EQ. Here is one. I have to read the background story for this one. You guys who studied Zen, you know this background story. Long ago, there was an old woman who had supported a hermit monk for 20 years. She had a 16-year-old girl bring him meals. One day, she instructed the girl to embrace the monk and ask, "How do you feel right now?" The young girl did as told, and the monk's response was, "I'm an old withered tree against a frigid cliff on the coldest day of winter." When the girl returned and repeated the monk's words to the old woman, she exclaimed, "For 20 years I've been supporting that base worldling." The old woman chased the monk out and put the hermitage to fire. So here's his poem. Here's his poem about that. The old woman was big-hearted enough to elevate the pure monk with a girl to wed. Tonight, if a beauty were to embrace me, my withered old willow branch would sprout a new shoot. So then, when EQ got to be older, like in his 50s, he did settle down. He quit going to whorehouses, and he fell in love with a blind singer named Mori. Some of you guys remember this, because we studied this. And she was quite a bit younger than him, but he stayed with her for the rest of his life. And he wrote lots of poems. Let's see, is there any poem about... Oh, yeah, here's a poem about about that. Every night, blind Mori accompanies me in song. Under the covers, Two mandarin ducks whisper to each other. We promise to be together forever, but right now this old fellow enjoys an eternal spring. So that's EQ. That's the red thread Zen. So the Zen emphasis on being naturally human. We're naturally human. We make mistakes. We screw things up. We get anxious all the time. We carry that anxiety around. We bring it to our Zazen. It's gone for a couple minutes, and then it comes back and follows us around. We worry about our bodies. All that stuff is naturally human. But if we're here and now, present with what is, we can experience, if we settle down in our sitting, in our meditation, unconditional worth. And then we see both sex and death as both paradoxical and humorous. And humorous. There's a lot of humor in Zen about sex and death, not in the rest of Buddhism. If you can find any humor about sex and death in the Nikayas, show it to me. Show it to me. I don't think so. I don't think so. Cemetery meditations. One of the Nikayas approach. This is not bad. Not a bad approach. But the body is pussy. It's decaying. If you really want to go do Zazen, go do it by decaying bodies and see how pussy and yucky they are. That's actually okay up to a point, because they are. We can't depend on it. It is going away. It is going away. And it is pussy. But that pus is a sign of life. Sign of life. It's a sign of vitality. And even as it dies, it becomes alive. So in Zen, we emphasize this world here. The beginning of Zen, he held up the flower. He didn't say go to the cemetery. He held up the flower. Supposedly, and then a few hundred later, Gute held up the finger, the flower, the finger. Even if the finger is a little crooked, it's still the finger. And then the shit wiping stick. Chinese Zen, they held up the shit wiping. This is the Buddha. Take care of this. How many hours did Katagiri Roshi over the years talk about taking care of toilet paper? How many times about toilet paper being Buddha? If toilet paper wasn't Buddha, who was? Still, in Asia, Zen hierarchy has been patriarchal, it has been sexist, it has been misogynist, and latently homophobic for centuries. Priests took vows of celibacy until 150 years ago in all the traditions. Something happened in Zen 150 years ago. I don't know what. We need someone who's... maybe Taigen could tell me about that. Someone who's really been a scholar. Oh, yeah? Is that right? Oh, so Susan knows something that I don't know about this. I'd be interested in learning that. Who'd you learn that from? Thank you. Thank you. Did you hear what she said? No.
It was a political thing.
Oh, I see. So they had to get married. Had to get married? I mean, what about Vimalakirti? What about the oneness of samsara and nirvana? What about Layman Pang? What about... had to get married. I mean, we've been preaching this since the beginning of Zen. The Taoist teachers have. Tibetans were not influenced by Taoism. So Tibetan is a whole different scene. And I just don't know that much about it. I can't really comment very intelligently on it. But 150 years ago, they finally started marrying. And but Suzuki Roshi... one of the reasons, this is just this, he wanted to come to the United States was because as a married monk, as a married priest, he could never become abbot of a Heiji or Sojiji. You couldn't, I don't know if you can now, but when he was there, still then, a married man was a little bit lower, because a married man had sex with women, and had kids, and so we are doing some major transformational thing here in the United States since 1960, really, is when we started doing it. We've been working on it for what's that, 45 years, 49 years. Yeah, well, we've done pretty well. We're doing, but of course, it's in our text anyway. It always says, "This body is the body of the universe." It always says that. So now we get a chance to finally do it, right? Duh. And we also have this other problem in the East, in Confucianism. Confucianism put down the woman, too. The woman was subservient, the woman was weak, and Confucian culture really permeated Buddhist culture a lot. But we don't have any Confucianism here. Yeah. Yeah, sure, you'll have to speak loud.
If there was no testosterone, they get turned on at some point, all beings would be female. The true genital tract is female. And when you talk about genetics, and I hope I'm not boring you, females are XX. There's a lot of genetic material on those chromosomes. Males are XY. And sorry to tell you this, but I'm not saying that to stir a pot, but I'm just saying that I think it's important to keep in mind these very deep, primitive biological realities that I believe are the underpinnings of some of these constructs that the world has developed.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Kathleen. That's wonderful. So anyway, we're doing this practice here. We have a chance to still our minds enough to appreciate this unconditional worth of all the XX chromosomes and all the XY and all the fragile ones that are going. I guess we're going, and you guys aren't. Appreciate them, envelop them, take care of them. And we're in the world. We're here at Zen Center doing this. And we're also out in the world. Over the years, people have wanted, had said to me, especially the first couple of years I was here, wouldn't I quit my job and just be full-time here? And, you know, I didn't want to, partly because of selfish reasons, but partly it's not my paradigm. My paradigm is the emerging of samsara and nirvana. My paradigm is the bodhisattva is in the world, but not of it. My paradigm, my personal paradigm, we all have personal paradigms, I'm not saying this is right, is that to be out there with people, helping them and supporting them, and getting screwed up yourself, but doing your best just to be in stillness is more important than to be here, sequestered. Because that's the Bodhisattva vow. So I'm close on that. Thank you. Oh, let's see. Is there time for questions? Well, no. Well, I don't know. 11 o'clock. Well, Kathleen already gave a really good talk, so no.